Hey everybody, this is Greg with the Brothers Wiss, number 134. Today we have a couple of friendly smiling faces. Look at that. We have Tommy Krogan from Colorado.
Hello.
Yep.
Said it correct, right?
Yep.
All right. All right. You've drilled it into my head enough. We also have Mikey from Chicagoland.
How's it going?
Excellent. Sounding good. Sounding crisp. Sounding clean. Thanks for the reboot, bud.
I was at 99.9% CPU usage. I figured that I would do our fans a favor and reboot before we did this.
Mm-hmm. This become part of my process every time is to reboot. I don't know why, but OBS, whenever I pull the NDI feeds in, it is like super intensive on my machine. So if I don't have like a fresh reboot for whatever reason, it just things get weird. That's how we get the interesting like snap shows or flipbook sort of podcast video stuff. So gotta keep it clean, keep it rebooted. All right, let's get stuff out of the way. We have a new patron this go around. His name is Shan, and he's from Australia. Another Aussie. Man, we are quickly becoming outnumbered. We are us North Americans are going to be the minority in no time. I'm excited about it with their typing accents.
Yeah, let's see here. So there are 11 people in the Aussies channel. There's only 6 in the United States of America channel.
We have a United States of America channel?
I made that when I saw how dominating the Aussies were. Yeah. I was like, oh, we have an Aussies? Now we need a U.S. There's 6 of us in there.
Ridiculous. All right. Well, if you're in there, I don't want to be in there. What do they say? It's like, I won't be part of any club that'll have me as a member. Isn't that what?
Greg, I checked. You are in there.
I know. Yeah. I'm just, you don't even know. I'm just sneaky. All right. Let's get the vegetables out of the way so we can get to the dessert. So I'll do QuickBit. QuickBit.com, KWIKBIT.com. They do some really cool indoor and outdoor 60 gigahertz kit. You can look at it for your point-to-point, or they're doing point-to-multi-point. I want to say it's up to 8 clients on a hub. That's their nomenclature they use. When you have a hub, you can have up to 8 clients, and they say you're supposed to get good speed, where I know some of the other guys that have affordable 60 gig radios, once you get up, in the number of clients in those point-to-multi-points have problems, but you get solid distance. You also get really cool deployment tools. You get a good price, and there's an API, which I'm a big fan of the API. So you can visit these guys at quickbit.com. All right, who's next?
I'll take dibs on the RF coverage then. Or tower coverage, wow. Tower coverage is your RF propagation system to empower your network. Real-time data metrics enable your coverage area, reaching your customer base, and more. The industry's best RF propagation mapping system allows website integration for customer sign-up and pre-qualification. Use this data to scientifically plan your network and expansion and help your WISP succeed. Get a free trial today at towercoverage.com. And I was actually, it is really cool to see WISP that have like, hey, this is our area. And it does, it's kind of fun to just kind of check that out when you're internet stalking people.
Or, somebody says, hey, what do you got in this area? Mm-hmm. or it's not your area, but somebody else is over there. You can say, hey, take a look at this, see if you fit in there, right?
Yeah. No, I have several of my neighboring WISPs. Have it, and so I'm able to very quickly make reference, say, oh hey, I can't do anything for you, but these guys show that they can, and I know one of your neighbors is on them as well, so go to them. And so it is really handy for that.
Hey, rock and roll. All right, Mikey, what you got?
We are also brought to you by Sonar, a scalable, intuitive, and comprehensive ISP billing and operational support system. Learn more at sonar.software.
All right, rock and roll. All right, we got all the sponsors out of the way. So I thought normally we start with like light little stuff. I thought let's try mixing up the format a little bit. Let's do kind of a discussion one and then maybe some little lighter stuff kind of in between. What do you think?
Sure.
Excellent. All right, so I saw there was a post on preventing rogue DHCP servers, and I saw there were some answers, so I kind of skipped across it. And then today when I was going back and reviewing, there was over like 130 messages on that one thread. So I was thinking, wow, I guess, you know, that's enough discussion where we should probably kind of put a little bit of information out there. So rogue DHCPs can be problematic in a lot of different environments. Normally we think about them kind of in our, hanging off our towers or kind of in an MDU environment, right? It's also an enterprise problem, and everybody kind of goes about it in a different, slightly different way, I think. It also kind of depends on the equipment you're using, right? And the medium you're serving that stuff on. But I guess from the WISP perspective, Tommy, you were the first one to chime in on that thread. So what were your thoughts on it?
So I was by far and above the least, one of the lesser contributors to that conversation, because my solution is absolutely terrible and
well first
is not what anyone else in the industry
let's
does.
Say well you have a rogue DHCP server. What is that? That's like somebody plugs in their home router backwards, right? And they're
traditionally for a WISP, that's what you're going to be seeing. But that's not the only thing that can happen. Actually, I just was dealing with one myself. I had set up a PowerBox Pro, a MikroTik PowerBox Pro, inside this customer's network to just act as a PoE switch because I just needed something fast, simple, and easy and managed. And I was like, ah, perfect. So I went in, turned off the DHCP, or left the DHCP client on, got rid of port one, made it put all in the bridge, got rid of all the firewall rules, got rid of static IPs and anything like that. I was like, ah, perfect. Everything's good. Plugged it in, plugged in the camera that I, or the access point that I needed it to power, and went about my day. And then later on, the customer calls me and is like, hey, I need to be able, you know, what's the password? I'm like, oh, what do you want it to be set? Can you access it? Because the access point that was plugged into it was pulling a DHCP server, DHCP IP from it instead of the actual network DHCP server for the client. And of course, other devices in the client's network was starting to pick up IPs from the other, from the MikroTik DHCP server. And it's like, God dang it. Oh, that was so stupid. So luckily I was able to get in, turn that off, let everything settle out and figure itself out. But basically rogue DHCP server is anything that you don't control and isn't supposed to be where it's at. Most of the time, you're going to see that as a customer plugging in the router in backwards. Most customer routers are going to be running DHCP, which gives out an IP address to devices. And that's going to, at the very least, if you don't have some way to block that, it's going to get onto your management network. And if you have a large layer 2 network, it's going to go to other customers. And say you have a very large layer 2 network with several backhauls in between your router and your customer, and then the customers on the same access point, if they're all using DHCP, they're going to ask for a DHCP address. And the first DHCP server to respond is what gets listened to, because right, it's just a broadcast.
It's basically a foot race, right? Whichever server happens to answer back quicker, yep, he's gonna hand the client the address, and Bob's your uncle. He's going to grab it and go.
If you can control it, it's a good thing. You can have multiple DHCP servers running, and if one fails, you know, another one picks up the ball. Mm-hmm. Except, you know, obviously in this scenario, you don't necessarily control it.
Correct. Yeah. So, which is actually can sometimes work for you. A lot of customer routers are actually pretty slow about handing out DHCP addresses. They are underpowered. They may just have a built-in delay for it. There's several different reasons, but multiple times I have found that when a customer plugs their router in backwards, instead of them handing out IP addresses to the rest of my network, what I end up doing is I'm handing out IP addresses to inside of their network. So which works pretty well for me, because what I do is a VLAN to each customer, and then I just do a /20 of private IPs to them, and so they can hook up to 32 different devices with the router plugged in backwards, and their stuff's going to continue working for the most part. So that's, you know, you can, there's a lot of different solutions. Mine is bad. There's the big. So the two big solutions to, well, three, I guess you could say. First one would be having a routed network. You route all the way to the CPE, and the CPE is in router mode, and it's acts as a router, DHCP, all the other stuff. And then you don't have to deal with this problem. You don't have a layer two between your customer's network and your network and your other customer's network, so you solve the problem. The trouble with that is that you're going to have higher CPU load on your CPE devices, which traditionally are not very high powered. Also, there's been some issues with firewall rules and NAT rules, just in general, just CPU utilization, particularly with Ubiquiti equipment. Historically, there's been several different issues. I know a lot of the WISPs use Cambium, they all seem to use routed mode, and it seems to work pretty well for them. So maybe it's just a device manufacturer, maybe there's others, but I always see people complaining about that, and it seems to be, you know, there seems to be bugs with that. So I always recommend try to run your equipment, your CPE, as, you know, as minimal what it can do. So layer two bridge. If you're going to go layer two bridge route, the two major solutions are DHCP option 82 and what was the other one? You know, trusted ports or something like that. Mike, maybe you were involved with that. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Isolation. Okay. And Mike, maybe you can describe that a little bit more because I'm not extremely familiar with it.
There's different terms for different manufacturers, right, in different spaces. A lot in the wireless space, you'll have client isolation. In switches, it's usually called port isolation. There's some other terms that I can't come up with right at the top of my head. And basically, it's just a checkbox or something you turn on in your device that prevents downstream devices from talking to each other in any way at all, other than, you know, hairpinning through the, you know, upstream port. So on an access point, no client could talk to any other client. On a switch, you know, the trunk port going to your router is the only one that can talk to more than one device. And in that scenario, they can't communicate with any other device in any way. So it's not just DHCP, rogue server blocking, but it blocks everything.
Yeah. And that's a security router anyway. That's a security bonus too, right? So if there's client isolation, you can't, like, one client can't try and, like, man in middle the other people, you know, with, like, gratuitous ARPs or anything like that. So, you know, if they can't talk to each other, it cuts out a lot of problems. Now, say you've got a client hanging off the same tower and they need to do like a VPN tunnel between the two, or they need to communicate, then client isolation kind of breaks that. So you have problems there.
It
sort of, but what it does, it just pushes it up to the router and the router has to route it.
Yeah. Oh, well, in a lot of people's, like hanging off an AP, that's one layer two network. So if they're all in the same subnet, with client isolation, then they'll never actually go through the router, right? If they're trying to hit a device on the same side.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that's true.
Layer two. Something else you're talking about, if you put your CPE in router mode, I was thinking, well, you've got an IP on it that's in stream of you, so you can actually trace through that device. You can probably ping that device, which means now if there's any vulnerabilities that hit that CPE, anybody inside that, well, I mean, if it's privately addressed, people on the internet aren't going to be able to get to it, but anybody inside your network could theoretically exploit it. Wherein if you have it in layer two mode, like you were talking about, Tommy, if only the management network can get to that IP, then, you know, it lowers the attack surface on your CPEs, which is another thing to think about.
Like that point is often, like, I talk about, you know, the routed CPE versus bridge CPE, probably about once a month or so on Facebook, you know, someone brings it up, you know, because a lot of people are pushing towards the, you know, bridge mode, bridge mode, bridge mode. All of mine are in routed mode. All mine work just fine in router mode. And on the topic of, I lost my train of thought. On the topic of, you know, security, it's like, yeah, you know, then my device is potentially compromised. But I can engineer around my own issues. You know, I'm managing my firmware updates. I know that, you know, I have firewall rules to block things. I know that my devices are still getting, whereas if somebody has a, you know, WRT54G original firmware as their router, I can't imagine that takes very long to get exploited. And I have no control over that. You know, if I screw up, I can fix it myself and it's on me for screwing it up. But if my customer, who is not a tech savvy person and has no idea of that they can even log into a router, much less update the software, then my network is still participating whatever compromise that they are having. I just can't do anything about it.
Well, I just think about all of the WISPs that were hit, maybe not just once, but even multiple times with like the Ubiquiti firmware vulnerability. So yeah. It's like, mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of us probably try and use good practices, but then, you know, there's a chunk of us that honestly, I don't know anybody that was running at least some Ubiquiti in their networks. Well, I can't say that. I'm sure I do know some people. But it seems like the vast majority of them had at least like one device hit, you know, somewhere out there. There was a device that was just off their radar in their network that got hit. So it's, you know,
I think I had two.
There you are.
Yeah,
it was just ones that, you know, weren't in air control, so they didn't get updated, and, you know, that's what it was.
Yeah, we had a whole group of them. It's like 16 or 32, somewhere in there, range. And if one antenna had gotten a public IP because the customer, I don't even remember the whole story, but it got a public IP, so it was accessible to by the internet, and then all the stuff in that layer two got compromised. It's like, and we spent weeks hunting down and clearing out that was a huge pain in the neck. Luckily there wasn't particularly anything bad that
too
happened
much fallout,
with
yeah.
that, but yeah. But so, as Mike said, though, you can firewall. A lot of people who are running Bridge Layer 2 don't even have a management VLAN for their equipment. It's all in the same network, and so all the customers can see each other. All the customers see the same all the customers get the same broadcast traffic. So you do get a lot of benefits out of running your customers on a routed CPE. You do have to deal with double NAT problems. You have to have the customers set up their router as either access point to avoid double NAT issues, or push IPv6 so gaming stuff works fine for them, some other portion of, you know, other routing tricks that you can pull off. But yeah, there's pluses and minuses with all of them. The final solution was DHCP option 82, and we spent a lot of time talking about that. And what that does is you tell your CPE, when you see this type of packet coming from this port, mark it with this information and send it along the way. Normally what that information is will be the MAC address of the CPE. It can be other information that's unique to the CPE. It could be information about the customer's plan, or even just their customer number. There's a lot of different solutions to that, and using DHCP option 82, and it usually integrates with your billing system. And what it does is once that DHCP request has been marked with where it's coming from, your DHCP server can say, okay, this is coming from John Doe, who gets bandwidth plan and gets this IP address and hasn't paid his bill, so we're going to actually turn off his bandwidth. So you can, if you have all that integrated with your billing system, you can have very, very fine-tuned control for how your customers get their routing information. And you can even say, okay, well then now he's going to go into this special plan because he hasn't paid, and which means that he gets special routing information. So you can do all this cool stuff with it. And that seems to be where a large portion of the industry is going, just because you have very tight integration with a lot of different billing systems, and you can do a lot of different things with it that you really can't do with the other solutions.
That's interesting.
So just, yeah.
As I say, I've never seen anybody use DHCP Option 82 to try and prevent rogues. I've always seen it as like it adds identifier information on where it came from. So when it hits the central like DHCP server, it's able to like say, oh yeah, it's hanging off this port, so it's going to be this customer, and then it hits your authentication system. Mm-hmm. What I have seen people use, especially like I use it in my MDU environments, is DHCP snooping. It's where you have on your switch, you have trusted ports and untrusted ports. So your trusted ones are going to be like your uplink ports, your trunk port that's going towards your known good DHCP server, and the other ones are considered untrusted. And so when you turn it on, in essence, it just blocks anybody from those untrusted ports from acting as a DHCP server. In like Cisco switches, it builds this thing called the DHCP snooping binding table, which is a horrible name. I don't know why they just didn't call it the snooping table, but it makes this mapping. So whenever your client actually attempts to, pull a DHCP, it sends a DHCP request. Well, it marks that in there. And then when it gets a response, it goes ahead and maps that IP to that MAC address. And you can actually lock it down with some additional features to where if you see any MAC addresses coming from that port that aren't in that snooping binding table, it'll just drop it. It's like, no, you didn't request an IP, so I'm sorry, I'm not going to let you do that. So you can get really granular. On the MikroTik, so like in my MDU, that's what I'm doing with my edge switches. So I'm using like the 328s, and I've got DHCP snooping in there, so that way there's no option for any rogues. Of course, I've got like wireless access points in all of their units, and I'm just doing layer 2 off those access points back to my DHCP server. So really, they'd be putting a hat on a hat if they tried to put an extra wireless router in there, because it's like dedicated just to them in their room. But, theoretically it happens, so it makes sense to put that stuff in place. Now, I have in the past on the MikroTik 3 series, like the 328s, the 3 anything, it does hardware DHCP snooping. So if you enable it, it still does hardware offload, right? So it's using your ASICs, so you get maximum throughput. But on the like 100, the CRS 100 and 200 series, if you try and turn on the DHCP snooping option, it actually turns off hardware offloading and it runs everything through the CPU, and you're going to have a bad time. So what I've found you can do is, and I always forget, it's like UDP port 67 or 68. I've actually got a blog post on it, but you can block that in a bridge filter from coming from any client ports. And I think, I can't remember how many, but you can do like maybe like up to 10 bridge filter entries, and it'll stay in hardware offload mode on those 100 and 200 series. So you can kind of fake DHCP snooping by just blocking the ports that a DHCP server would respond on those. So that's kind of one little cheat you can do there. But snooping is for the most part how I've done it. Now, what I've also noticed is running DHCP servers in MDU networks is I always try and put on some monitoring as well. Just in case you replace a piece of equipment, you don't have the configuration 100% right. That's bit me multiple times, like where everything's perfect, and it's running great for a year, and then some piece of equipment breaks and somebody will go and swap it out and they'll forget to like turn all that stuff on, and then we'll get a rogue DHCP. So I remember originally in the MikroTik, whenever you set up a DHCP server, there's an option for like detect, I can't remember the, it's like detect rogue in there, but that actually worked for a little minute, and then somewhere in there it quit like functioning right. Like it wasn't alerting us when that was happening. So what I ended up doing was I added, you know, cause we would, dump that, dump all the notifications off to a syslog server and we'd match on it. So we'd get an alert, say, oh, there's a rogue, you know, when obviously there shouldn't be. So what we ended up doing is since that kind of quit working, they may have subsequently fixed it. I'm not sure. I haven't seen it in a while, but I would run DHCP clients on all of the ports and I would just turn off like learn gateway and, learn DNS. And if it pulled an IP, it would send off a syslog message and then we'd know we'd have a rogue. So we actually had both like their server-based detection and a client running, like kind of a belt and suspenders sort of, hey, send us a notification and we can pop in there and take a look really quick. Now, a bad idea is to set a DHCP client and accidentally leave the add gateway feature. Golly, yeah, because we've obviously done all this the wrong way. And then a rogue will go in there and so it'll pull a new default route and well, of course, that'll screw it up and you can't get to that apartment complex. Oh, man. So yeah, definitely turn the learn gateway off. But that's kind of the ways we've done detection because yeah, it's I mean, it's great to put all that stuff in place, but it's also nice to actually know that it's working. So just in case something magically pops up on the network, you know, you'll detect it because inevitably you'll fat finger a configuration. Even if you're, you know, there's process and procedure, there'll be break fix and somebody will be just hustling and you know how it goes.
Yeah. It's Christmas Eve. They want to get home to their family.
Yeah. Anyone get this working things. Yeah. So I would definitely recommend you guys look for some detection. Like if you're running centralized DHCP servers, add some detection in there for rogues as well. Cause you know, if it does pick one up, you can mitigate it really quick, right? Cause it'll give you the IP address. You can go to the ARP table, look up the MAC address that host is coming from. And then just track them down in your layer 2 network and shut the port down real fast or whatever it is you have to do to get everybody up and working again.
Yeah. And to correct myself, option 82, you do need to be utilizing DHCP snooping for it to work.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. So those go hand in hand. I'm not super familiar because I went my own crazy way. So,
hey, man, if your crazy way like super duper works for you, is it really that crazy?
Yeah, it makes my life nice and easy, and I get to say I do it weird.
Hey, man.
And I enjoy doing that.
That's the beauty part of all of this. Yep. There's actually several ways you can do all this stuff. Luckily, I don't have to deal with wireless CPEs anymore, so I get to just do it all in a wired environment where it's like much more controlled. Because I don't know, I just feel like you've got a lot more power when you're doing it all in the switch. You know, as opposed to having to, you know, because every wireless manufacturer does it just a little bit differently and they don't all have feature parity and stuff like so. It's, you know, you kind of.
Yeah, and you never know when some update is going to break it for, you know, especially when you're a crazy person like me or Mike who runs multiple different wireless companies as our access point in CPE. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So just the very, all the craziness. That's why I didn't want to do it is because it's, you know, every few months you see somebody, oh, this is broken now. Great. So I just was like, well, I'll do it this way. VLANs, no one ever breaks VLANs.
Quote. Yeah. I also like to do port isolation on my switches too. But since a unit has its own access point in there, I let everybody communicate inside the unit themselves. So like if they stick a Chromecast in, you know, or a Roku, they can still connect to it, but they can't get to anybody else's stuff in any of the other apartments. So kind of, that's sort of how I worked around it, but still keep them as isolated as possible. All right.
Do you, you don't do public IP to the unit, do you? No, you just NAT them.
Yeah, I just NAT them. It's a bunch of college kids. They don't care.
Yeah.
They're just going ham on their Netflix and their Hulu. And I see when they get their Call of Duty updates and they're not killing anything yet. So we're good.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that was a very long, and, you know, there's definitely religious battles as to the proper way to do it and, you know, which is the better way and which companies. So there's definitely some religious battle involved with that. I avoided it because it's just me, and I assume Mike, has his own opinion.
In terms of the religious battles, I find a way to piss everybody off as I route on the CPE and I use POE.
Yeah, that's why I did the VLANs too.
But I have never had that problem.
All right,
never had the problem.
So let's see. Let's mix it up a little bit. I saw an article that was kind of interesting and I thought refreshing, and it was, and I didn't read the whole thing. I really just read the blurb that was interesting to me, is that Starlink, you know, SpaceX's, you know, new internet provider, is planning on having just a single tier for their customers, like just a single plan. Now I think they said consumer plans, which to me says you're going to have some kind of business tiers that are, you know, probably going to have different service level agreement, you know, SLA and maybe speeds and things like that, which you would expect, right? I'm assuming they're going to make a good chunk of change off business connections, not just consumer. I think consumer is just helping them, you know, battle test their network, but I'm assuming they're going to want to make a lot of money off business customers that are really in need of this stuff.
Oh,
but
yeah,
just the concept of, you know, you go to a restaurant and they say, here's your sandwich. And they're like, but I don't want a sandwich. Here's your sandwich. I just thought it was interesting. You know, like one size fits all. What do you think about that? Because it's also...
Well, that's kind of what the mobile guys
do. It's a basic,
like, you know,
$99,
if you want
bucks,
internet,
right?
On your phone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So their plan starts at $99, which means if you're a WISP, theoretically, and you're underneath that by some margin, you know, maybe there's still some room for you to compete even against their higher speeds and lower latency. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, like, my most expensive plan is $100. So, it, you know, price is of any concern whatsoever, I win.
Mm-hmm.
As long as I don't suck.
Yeah.
Then I win.
I mean, for a lot of people, the difference between $70 and $99 is pretty significant, so.
Yeah, and the speed difference, you know, and the, you know, usability of 20 megs compared to a gig, it's like, well, 20 megs probably covers everything you need.
Yeah.
So if $30 makes a big deal to you, don't.
What are your thoughts, T-Cent?
Starlink is very much the hot topic. So preface with, I will kind of give my general thoughts / what it seems to me has been the general consensus of the WISP world, is that as long as Starlink works well, you're going to be seeing between 20 to 200 megs, and that's what we've been seeing so far and continuously increasing that. I think $100 seems high to me. For one size fits all, definitely leaves a lot of room for competition, which maybe that's what their idea is, hey, we're going to be where there's no other option, and or you want to have us as your option, and it's going to be a quality of life improvement in some ways. Particularly, there's a lot of WISPs out there that still offer 3 megabit plans, and you're paying more than $10 for that, which is absolutely insane. You just see all these guys who are doing crazy stuff. You know, and there's lots of reasons for it. It's not all malice. It's not pure just stupidity. There's usually good reasons for it.
Yeah.
But those guys will be very much put under the water, I think, in a lot of ways, unless they have really awesome service, and or they aren't actually giving those speeds that they're advertising. They're giving more than that. That said, there's definitely a lot of, in rural communities, not appreciation for Elon Musk, and definitely an appreciate and want to support the rural or local provider, which goes only so far, but such is life. So, personally, I think that wirelessly we'll be able to continue compete with our current technologies with Mimosa and Ubiquiti. Really, I have so many business customers that are paying me for 100 plus megs, and they rarely ever use it, other than one customer in the middle of the night does backups up to some server that lets them get up to 50 megs per second, and that's it. And I go out and test all the time and make certain that they're getting it, and we can do speed tests. They get their speed tests, but the rest of the internet, like, I was downloading Wikipedia earlier this morning, I could max out at around 15 megabits per second. Like, nobody wants to supply their band, like, have all of their server's bandwidth going to a single person. They're going to split that up anyways. You're never going to see that unless, like, Steam, there's some date occasions like Steam, stuff like that, torrents. So it's really infrequent that you're going to have issues with your bandwidth on something under 25 megs, or 25 around there. So I think a lot of people, they'll be all right. I'm not too terribly worried about it. I do worry for companies that won't be adjusting the speeds that they're at least advertising and able to provide. But yeah, one size fits all, and at $100, just that seems high, but it could be a goodwill offering. You know, Elon could be like, hey, I'm not going to piss, I really don't want to piss everyone off at $60, because then he really would harm a lot of the industry.
Well, and so if I were them, Starlink, I would, it's, you know, they're in it to make money like anybody else. It's like, what, you know, and, you know, supply and demand, at what point can I still sell all of my supply? If they can still sell all their supply at $100, then selling it for anything less than $100 is foolish. You're just setting money on fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you leave it. Yeah, you never want to leave money on the table, right? But finding that magic sweet spot is difficult sometimes.
And I mean, you know, if they could fill up at $200, sell it for $200. Who cares if it's not for everybody then? If you still sell out at $200, then you've still sold out.
Yeah.
Somebody that probably will lose, not so much on the speeds, are people that do data caps. I just pulled up HughesNet and Viasat. Obviously, those have pretty universal, well, continental availability. And, you know, Viasat, they've got $70, $100, $150. Okay, you know, they've got one that's less, but it's only got 40 gigs of data. I mean, that's not a lot of data for a house.
Yeah. I know some guys that work at Viasat, I know some guys that work at Viasat, and they were saying that, part of it was COVID, but after Elon's birds got up there and they really started, you know, like the beta program started picking up, that their stock prices really started taking a hit, and there was a lot of fear and uncertainty inside the company. And I know they did some downsizing, so I think they're battening down the hatches. I think they're pretty afraid.
Like HughesNet, they've got 40, 50, 80, and 130, so they still have a plan that's more expensive, but it's 10 gigs, 20 gigs, 30 gigs, 50 gigs, 10 gigs. I'm on my Wi-Fi for 90% of my time, and I still manage to do 10 gigs a month on my cell phone. I can't imagine a home being satisfied with 10 gigs a month. I mean, what was the last Call of Duty update? 50 gigs.
Yeah, and that's...
You'd max out the biggest plan here.
Yeah, well, and that would be just doing updates. You aren't even gaming on that. That's just so you can play single player.
Yeah. The latency going up to space is just horrible. Like, you know, for those higher orbit satellites.
Yeah. So, and that's the advantage that Elon Musk satellites supposedly are going to have. We don't have a lot of conclusive evidence so far. I know there's a couple people in the Slack that have Starlink, and there's a couple people that were, what was that, Nlog, or what's the group out of, was it Sweden, I think, Mike, that have the international monitoring, and you can do ping tests and such.
I know what you're talking about. Somebody added a note on their Starlink, right?
Yeah, they added a note. I can't remember the name of the of who it was, but they added it. And when I was looking at it, the latency was all over the place. So it's like, okay, well, we're going to have to definitely sit and
get some... Ripe Atlas.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, when we have some conclusive evidence, I think we can make some decisions. But theoretically, Elon's stuff is going to be very, very... Starlink is going to be very low latency. Mm-hmm. Because you're only going a couple hundred miles up into space, speed of light's really fast. From there, when his whole network is set up, he's going to have supposedly lasers between his satellites doing comms, and so you can go international or intercontinental traffic at faster than fiber, and even, you know, inside of the United States, I think the latency is like somewhere around 70 to 80 milliseconds. For some of the faster paths from New York to Los Angeles or whatever. And Starlink is supposed to be somewhere in the 40s or something. I can't recall, 20s or 40s. But people have done the math. You're going to have lower latency with Starlink.
Isn't that just crazy to maybe think that's about? Not... Satellites shooting lasers at each other?
Oh, yeah. That's
really bonkers. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, like, well, and so... I think the laser aspect is new, but the satellite-to-satellite communications aspect is 20 or 30 years old. Because your sat phones, like the Inmarsats and whatnot, they have LEO constellations. You know, now there's not as many birds in the air, you know, but they've, you know, they've got low Earth orbit constellations, and so they're, you know, as they're over the Pacific, they have to relay from satellite to satellite to get to, you know, an Earth station. It's just not as much bits. I mean, you've got, I don't know how many phone calls they carry, but they're phone calls. They're not YouTube
just
streams.
Just a few K each. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense. I just, I thought it was interesting. Like, the single tier. So like, I believe it or not, I used to do wedding photography for like 7 or 8 years for a long time, right? So I've always like had multiple jobs for whatever reason. Well, it's because I'm terrified that the rug will get pulled out from underneath me. But needless to say, that actually helped make ends meet. My wife told me subsequently, like years later, like, oh yeah, sometimes that was the only reason we were able to pay our mortgage because we were doing that. But when we started out, we had all these packages, right? Like Keeping Up with the Joneses, doing all this various stuff, and you could pick and you know choose, and that became like over time it just became tedious, and we started paring it down until I think the last 2 years we just had this thing we called the wedding. It's like there's no pick and choose, there's no this or that, we just do everything and you take it or you leave it, and it made life so much easier. So like I wish we had like one, you know, we had to prove ourselves for a little while, you know, to kind of build up clientele, but the idea of being able to start off like with just, here's the thing, take it or leave it, that is like so attractive of an idea to me. So I thought that was really cool that they're doing that. I don't know. I mean, we'll see how much success they have with it. I'm assuming they'll be just fine. But, you know, it sounds bold to a lot of us, I think.
Yeah. I mean, in general, I love the idea of here's the internet plan. Back when I was first doing like my learn as much as I possibly could. I can't remember the name of the guy. Mike probably remembers him. But he was a proponent of just connect everyone up to the network. Don't do any bandwidth limiting and just have a flat, flat plan. And that is what you do. And that was his like, and I was like, oh, that's kind of, I really like the concept of it. Admittedly, you have to have people that are going to play nice, because there's the various issues. And I assume Starlink isn't going to give you, you know, unlimited to your CPE. But it's really, really cool to be able to say if you could do it at a reasonable price. But the thing is, and the reason why I still have a basic plan that's 6 megs by 6 megs is I don't think anybody, I mean, there's people who just want to spend $35 a month and just want to browse Facebook. Like, I have a ton of customers that I even go out to customers and be like, hey, you're on my family plan. You don't use any bandwidth. You can save yourself some money every month. And when I'm talking to them about some issue or another, and you know, that engenders loyalty. And those same people, and when they're on Facebook, are saying, hey, Rogan Telephone is the best company, period, dot. So, you know, that's a selling point to having lower tier and being able to break out stuff, is that you can match it to the person better. But it is a cool dream to just be like, take it or leave it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sexy idea. Whether it's practical for the WISP, I'd say probably not, right? Because you have to track them. Some folks probably get in at your base tier, and then, you know, as their demands grow, then they can scale. You know, I mean, their connectivity can scale, and so you know, or as their budget scales, they can scale. So, you know, it gives them opportunity to do that stuff, because some folks just can't. You know, they can't afford the $100. Maybe they could do $50 a month, you know, and they could afford that, but not much more. You know, I do know a lot of Red Hatters that are struggling with decent connectivity, because it used to not be a problem for a lot of us. I say us, I got hired in the pandemic, so I never really got to travel. But most of these guys, you know, like in the sales org, they were putting in a lot of windshield time, you know what I mean? So they weren't necessarily at home, like, doing teleconferences. Well, everything has changed, and now everything is 100% remote now. So a lot of those guys are actually struggling, like, you know, being able to have good customer engagements, you know, and solid meetings and stuff. So some of them have, like, I know some of them on my team that have WISP connections that are in the local WISP is just terrible. They're just awful, and you don't have any other options. So I know a couple of them that are signed up for Starlink. They're on the waiting list, right? Just because they don't have any other options. So this is my new normal. I've got to do this for my job. And, you know, if I want to live not in the city, I have fallen in love with convenience. So I don't plan on moving out of the city anytime soon again. I've done that. And I like being able to drive 7 minutes to the grocery store right there, or DoorDash, quite literally anything. So I'm one of those people now. So I don't know. I'm always going to have decent connectivity, but I feel for the guys that can't.
Yeah. Oh, and you know, there's plenty of places where you're going to have whatever the tree cover is. And I don't know how good Starlink will be pushing through a solid wall of trees. You know, maybe you can get a clear shot of the sky if you have a tall enough pole
or big enough chainsaw.
Big enough chainsaw. That is always the answer to tree problems. But I think it's going to be really good for the industry. I think the WISP industry has had a really bad reputation because of the bad WISPs out there. And we say bad, but they don't do high speed broadband. Their support is, you know, they're just there because, you know, somebody built it and it's just running into the ground. Yeah. They don't upgrade. they have issues inside of their network with stuff crashing all the time.
Which of those bad habits do you feel is the most unforgivable for you? If you had to pick one thing to say, this is unforgivable. I know what mine is. I'm just curious what yours is.
Oof. I would say the not willingness to upgrade and compete, even though, like, particularly because, like, you have a service and people are okay with it. That just drives that drives me nuts, because that's what I've been fighting at my main work for a lot for the last few years, and making things, you know, increasing speeds in general, like that, improving the product. I hate it when I see a company and I'm browsing around the internet and I see something that was made 20 years ago. It was a great and amazing at the time, and they're just writing it out instead of improving the product. That kills me. I hate that. That's really unforgivable in my heart.
I was gonna say, for me, the number one most unforgivable thing is bad customer service, because good customer service doesn't, like, cost you any more money. You know, you don't have to, like, budget for good customer service. Like, it should be there from day one. You should create a culture of good customer service and push that forward. Because I just, like, these people that are WISP that need to do, right, they realize that they need to do these upgrades and stuff. They could still have great customer service, but most of the time they like ghost customers, and they just won't, you know, like, won't answer them, or they'll just blatantly lie to them about stuff. But if you were, like, you actually, like, tried, you took care of your customers, and you said, you know what? You know, we're budgeting. We've got this tower. We realize we need to do an upgrade on it. We see the problems, and here's the plan we've put in place. You know, like, just have good customer service. Yeah. People will be like, oh, I get it. I understand. You know, and, you know, they'll be on board with that. It's just, that's unforgivable to me. How about you, Mike? What's something that's unforgivable, you think, is a bad habit?
I would say probably what irks me the most is people that install CPE that have a greater negative impact on the network than than they get from it. So, like, the guy that says, you know, oh, you know, I got this customer hooked up at neg 80 and they can pull 15 megs. Great. But that means that one customer is now taking all of the airtime of that access point, and everybody else's service is going to suffer now. Even in the LTE world where there's supposed to be better controls and stuff, it's, you know, it's always, you know, because LTE, I think it's add 30 to, like, a decibel rating, and that's what their signal level is. That's okay for them. Like, you know, neg 90 is, like, the absolute floor for Wi-Fi. I think neg 120 is the absolute floor for LTE. And it's like, in SCE, you know, people, oh, you know, I got this customer online at neg 115. I'm like, no, everybody's going to have a bad... Everybody will have a bad experience, not just the new customer, everybody.
Yeah, I think LTE guys could really dominate the WISP world if they were to actually do outdoor CPEs and installs like a WISP does. Like, if they got their antennas down into, you know, neg 60s, that, you know, is the goal for a lot of people, or neg 50s or whatever. You had this really isolated antenna and such with spectrum that's all your own. Golly, Ned, what could you do as far as bandwidth wise? But then, you know, they abuse their ability to do negative 120 or some silliness, and they put the CPE indoors, and
I guess going off on an LTE tangent, you know, there's a variety of LTE manufacturers that target the WISP space with, you know, affordable gear. Now, still some of the most expensive WISP gear that there is, but it's much more affordable than Samsung, Nokia, or, you know, Ericsson base stations. Said, you know, there's a lot of people that are displeased with some of the WISP-focused LTE vendors and kind of giving LTE a bad name. Some of it not undeserved, but, you know, but you know, some of the WISPs that have tried Ericsson and went with a proper base station that does big boy stuff, they're happy with it. With the performance, obviously the equipment is much more expensive. You know, I think it's 2 to 3 times more expensive. You know, but it's the difference between, you know, gear that has a hard time staying running and has dependencies on, you know, I think for a long time one of the vendors had a dependency on a DNS server in a country that's not so US friendly. and they're, you know, 2x2. I think, yeah, they've been kind of working on 4x4. And like, you know, these other guys have, you know, 64x64. And so they can do the multi-user MIMO and all this fancy stuff, and they can push, you know, multi-gigs per E-node B. It's like, yeah, those are two totally different kinds of gear. And so it's like, you know, you show up with the cheapest stuff, and that's what you get. You get the cheapest result.
It makes sense, though. I mean, I could see both sides of the card. Like, I definitely like the idea of paying twice as much and then never having to think about the kit. Like, it just works. Like, that would be pretty baller. But then again, anything you hang up on a tower outside, you're never really going to be able to completely not worry about that. So,
yeah,
it is what it is. You kind of take that into consideration when you become a WISP, I suppose. Somebody put on here towers by airports. That feels like that's kind of in the same vein of what we're talking about. What's going on with that?
Oh, so we have a little WISP brother who is super awesome and trying to build his network down in, I want to say it's Puerto Rico.
Bermuda.
Bermuda, yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's out in the triangle.
Yeah, down there. And apparently in that country, basically they follow all this, they try to follow all the same FCC rules, supposedly, and then, but there's just all sorts of little weirdnesses in it. So he's always trying to find out what's the United States regulation, because then, you know, that's your starting point in Bermuda. And he was asking about how high can I build a tower if I'm like so far away from an airport and a landing strip and an airport. And I was like, wow, that's a really good question. I'm glad I'm nowhere near an airport, because that'd be a really bad day. That sounds miserable. I have to do that. And I guess Mike was the hero and came in with the answer for that. It's like 200 feet at what you want is, I think you said 2 miles.
Well, so somebody else came in with text that, you know, is what you're describing now, you know, 200 feet, this distance, so on. I showed up with the link to the FCC site where you punch in your Latin lungs and it'll just tell you what you need. It'll tell you if what you propose will clear.
Oh, okay.
So I was like, you know, screw trying to figure out what the formula is. They just give you a tool to tell you if it's good or not. So that's...
Don't worry about it. I suppose if you're close to an airport, there's probably special regulations on, like, tower color or lights that you have to have, stuff like that too, right?
All depending on where you are, too. You know, if you're in line with the runway, it's different. You know, distance and height requirements, you know, than if you're perpendicular. But you can't be perpendicular and still 500 feet. You have to, you know, it just ramps more, you know, it's a different slope. So it's, that's why, like, I've never tried to figure out what it is other than 200 is the max anyway. Like, you know, you're in the middle of nowhere. You can only go 200 feet before you gotta, you know, do all the lights and painting and stuff. That's all I ever remember. The other one's just like, I just go to the website, type it in.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That makes me think of, we went to Waco, for the first time in like a year and some change, not too long ago. And we're coming back in the dark, and the normal path we take, you see all of these lights blinking in unison that like weren't there a year and a half ago or whatever it was. And as we get in there, it's like, it's super eerie. It's just all these lights all around us are like synchronized, like on these towers. And eventually we get to where there's like just a little bit of dust coming this way. And it's a bunch of windmills, like wind turbines that they'd installed out there. And I was thinking, that's really clever to blink them all simultaneously. Cause if you had a giant field of those things all just popping at random intervals, it's like, man, that would be disorienting as hell. You'd probably lose track of what you're looking at. But man, those things are enormous. I don't know if you've ever been by one, but it's kind of creepy. It reminds me of like playing Half-Life Alyx. There's these big Strider things that like walk over you. That was the first thing that like popped in my head. It was like pretty creepy. It's pretty freaky.
Yeah, just going about doing their thing, and you don't want to mess with them at all in any way. I actually like it when the lights, there's actually a row of towers, and I like it when they are slightly out of sync, just because it makes it, but I think a field of them would be a little bit disorienting. But I think after a while I would really appreciate the light show for as much as it would be.
I don't know, maybe it would bother some people's epilepsy if they were all going at random intervals. God.
Yeah. That's probably why they did it all synchronized. The reason they did it all synchronized is some engineer somewhere was like, this has to be synchronized, dagnabbit. This is annoying me.
I can see a wind farm of, they got 120 to 150 turbines and out my window. And I've never looked to see officially why they do that. But one thing I kind of thought of is that the lights are on the top of the nacelle. They're not at the tip of the blade. Blade blinking at the peak.
Yeah, at its apogee, yeah. Because I think those blades are usually what, like at least 100 feet tall, maybe like more than, maybe like 120, 130. So cut that in half.
Yeah,
those blades are like 70 feet above where the light is.
No, so like ours, the blade itself is like 120 feet. So that blade does go 120 feet above the nacelle then. And so my thought was, that's how they let the pilots know, you know, if you see 100 lights blinking in unison, there's a wind farm there and you can't just fly over the light. You got to be, you'll pull up over that.
Unless you want to go through the blender.
Even on a tower, it's at the very top. So, you know, I'm not sure what the regulations are, but like, you know, you could fly, you know, with more certainty because it's at the top. But a wind farm, if you fly at that light, you're done.
Yeah, like water towers, all that stuff. The light's at the top, so you're, you know, as long as you're clearing that by a few feet, you're probably fine, but holy cow, yeah, those things, it's bonkers. And I think the blades too, don't the heads like turn towards the direction of the wind or whatever? So,
Yeah, so you have no idea where the blades could be at any point in time. That would, well, no, actually as a pilot, you're going to know what the crosswinds are or what the wind is doing. So you'd know which direction.
Yeah. We pulled over.
You could fly in line with the
blades. We pulled over next to one and parked and turned the car off and just rolled the window down. It sounded like, being at the ocean sort of. It's kind of cool. It's kind of soothing. I guess you'd probably get used to it.
It's like, and the people who are against them, like that sound is the most repulsive sound in the world. Oh my God, it's so violent. And it's like, have you been in the country on a windy day next to a tree? Because it's kind of the same.
Yeah.
Have you ever been near an airport international airport. Come on, people. Grow up here.
Yeah.
No.
Anyway, I digress. Yeah, towers by airports. Yeah. Well, I mean, also, towers by airports, if you're in like the 5 gigahertz range, you got to worry about DFS and stuff like that, right? What's DFS, Tommy?
Dynamic frequency coordination, right, Mike?
Well, coordination starts with a C.
Selection, right?
I think so.
Oh, right. Selection, yeah, right. Wow. DSD, wow.
And and so where I was going to kind of... Oh, I had something I was going to go off on a tangent with that. And And so actually, a lot of people don't fully grasp what all is covered by DFS. What draws the most press, I say, you know, I use the word press loosely because it's not as if CNN's reporting on it, but grabs the most attention is the terminal Doppler weather radars at, you know, there's 20 or 30 of them across the country near major airports that have specific probabilities of wind, you know, shear conditions. And so they have them there to measure wind shear. But they're only in 50 megahertz of that band. In the entire rest of the DFS space, you could have weather radars. You could have helicopter radars. You could have all kinds of stuff. So it's really easy to find where the 20 or 30 TWR are located. It's a sizably more difficult venture to figure out where all the weather radar are. Still reasonable. I mean, it's public data. You just gotta comb through it. It's in the FCC's ULS database, and I've got a Google map where if somebody's talking about having DFS conditions, whatnot, and I have available time, I will go look at ULS in their area and find where the commercial weather radars are. Usually it's TV stations. Every now and then you find a radio station or a newspaper that has one. But those are discoverable. But the main reason why DFS is so complicated to comply with is not because of the weather radars, is because of the military radars. And the military radars are on aircraft, and aircraft move. And being military radars, they're not going to tell you how it works. So that's why DFS is so tricky to make it work, is that the radio manufacturer is just going to have to guess and then submit it. Like, yeah, there's some frameworks, but then they have to guess and submit it, and then they tell you, nope, not good enough, try it again. There's a couple of WISPs that I know of near, major military installations, and obviously it's not all of them, but he says that there's times of the year when that those bands are unusable for 2-3 weeks because they're just conducting so many operations, and obviously a radar is much more powerful than your 10 milliwatt transmitter.
What I found out is so I know a guy that works in the air traffic control tower down here. We have a lot of military planes that come in and out, like doing exercises and stuff. And there's a certain set of planes that come in too that are equipped with all kinds of frequency jamming in it. So as those things come in, it kills the tower's radar. Like
E2C.
It jams them up. So those guys kind of like land in the dark on their own stuff. And so if you were anywhere near the DFS range by those guys, I don't know if they only crank it on when they're, I don't know. Maybe it always comes on, or maybe they're just doing it when it's exercise, or maybe it's just when they're landing. I have no idea. But I know that could be pretty problematic.
Let's see here. Can I share a picture? Yeah. No, it looks like it's too complicated. Yeah. So I guess, yeah, so towers by airports. Yeah, so and there is some regulation. I don't remember much about it because I haven't had to do it. That, like, I believe within a certain distance of an airport, you're supposed to coordinate all spectrum usage with them. All. Like, you can put up a 2.4 gig transmitter. Still got to coordinate it with them. What the distance is, I don't know. But, like, you know, it's not just licensed gear. It's not just DFS. And I don't remember the reason. And it sounds like it's almost like a blanket approval. Like, yeah, you're fine. Go ahead. I think it's just there as a safety check of, nope, don't do that. Because we're doing this one thing.
Kind of like the cell phones on the airplane problem.
Yeah, where it's, you know, it's illegal, but yet there's absolutely zero repercussion for doing it. Technical or, you know.
Mm-hmm. Repercussion or reason, yeah. Yeah, the other, it's DFS. So for those who aren't familiar or who haven't messed around with it a lot, there's a certain set of frequencies from 5.25 gigahertz.
Yep.
Through 5.330, I believe. And then 5.475 through 5.715 or something, I think. I can pull up a ubiquity access point and find out, but that's effort. But so those channels are shared spectrum. They aren't free willy go nuts like the UNNI 1 and 3, which is 5.55 through 5.4, you know, whatever the other number, 5.245. And then 5.735 through 5.850. So those two are respectively called UNNI 1 and UNNI 3. Those ones you don't have to use what's called dynamic frequency selection. You don't have to check to make certain that you're coordinated with your radio doesn't have to do those checks. You're basically, as long as you're following FCC rules, you can use the frequency and it doesn't matter who else is also using that frequency. DFS, on the other hand, requires that your access point spends 60 seconds ahead of time before using that frequency, making certain that that frequency is available and doesn't have particular radio patterns using it. And then while it is using it, it also has to continuously check to make certain that those patterns don't occur. And if they do, you have to the radio has to move immediately. And so that's the problem with DFS, is that, you know, you'll set your channel, you'll be within your legal limits, you'll have everything, there's no noise, you'll go weeks, months without having any issues, and all of a sudden your radio has changed its channel and is now stepping on other radios and then running into noise, and you have a bunch of customers who are either down or have bad, and for very little explanation, and it's called a DFS hit. And various types of radio manufacturers at various times will have firmware that seems to be less problematic. I would assume, at least from my general guesstimates, that would mean that it's less sensitive and may not be following the rules as properly. But I know that there's always guys pushing particular ubiquity firmwares because they say this one will let you use DFS and it's not going to have a problem. Mimosa as well. There's certain firmwares that guys are like, oh yeah, this is the one to use. And it's like, yeah, but they changed things so that they could be updated for regulations. We probably want to follow regulations. So as much as a pain in the neck it can be, I always recommend following a moderately modern firmware just for the fact that it, you know, you really don't want to be the guy to screw up those radio. You don't want to mess with other stuff, particularly weather radar, stuff like that. And they can see, and that is one thing that will get the FCC coming after you, is if you're on those frequencies and making noise and harming incumbent users for, you know, because you're there. And it's pretty easy to tell which direction you are from where those radio sites are, because it lights up like a Christmas tree. So,
you know, something I've always wondered about DFS is, I know like it'll sense those radio patterns, that it'll switch you to a different frequency. Does different manufacturers have a mechanism where it'll listen, and then when it goes quiet again, it'll move you back? Or is that always like a manual move back?
No, it'll move back. And so what's really hilarious is you'll get some sort of whatever the interference is. For me, it seems to be when Buckley Air Force Base is doing their maneuvers, and my brother has to go on, is doing some sort of work for making jets fly. Coordinates really well, so I know I have to move my stuff when he has drills. So when they're doing their stuff, I have to move off, but it'll go back, and the access point will go back. It'll sit there, and, you know, might last 5 minutes, might go 3 weeks, might go 2 months, but you'll have it. Mimosa has a preferred channel that you can say, hey, if this DFS channel isn't good, go over here. As your secondary, that's a pretty cool feature that they've added sometime in the last 6 months. Ubiquiti, I don't think, has a similar option. It just tries to choose a whatever channel it thinks is as if it were in auto mode. And Mimosa used to be the same way. I don't know about Canby and Mike. Do you know what they will do? Do they have like a preferred channel?
I think I set it to a channel. Then there you can configure, I think, two backup channels.
Okay. Yeah. So the major manufacturers have, or at least Mimosa, Cambium have it. Ubiquiti, I don't recall, but I'm a firmware behind latest right now. So I don't recall if that's a feature in the AC stuff. LTU might have that. The M line series might have that as well, but I'm just not super familiar with the M line anymore. I just don't use it at all. So yeah, you can have some of that. But I know for a long time, Ubiquiti didn't have, that, and it would just bounce back and forth off of, oh, bad channel. Okay, well, I'll sit here until the DFS wait clears. There's a particular amount of time that you spend that you have to wait. I want to say it's half an hour, but that could just be Mimosa's configured system. And then you're allowed to go back to that channel and try using it again, which means that you also have another minute of downtime, because your access point goes to that channel and you have to use the radio that's going to be transmitting, and it has to listen and make certain that there's no noise and no particular patterns. And then if that's available, great. After the 60 seconds of wait time, you can start having customers connect and start transmitting on it. So using DFS has a lot of negatives. That said, it's pretty frequently some of the most quiet spectrum that you're going to find. So it's, you know, you're six to one, half dozen of the other. You know, there's damned if you do, damned if you don't reasons. So,
you know, the one thing that's usually bothered me about DFS is there's a chunk of like indoor access points, you know, like Soho routers that don't support those frequencies. It's like, if I'm installing stuff in an MDU environment, you're cutting out so many clear channels for me. Like, you're making my life so miserable. It's like, why would this not exist in these devices? Because I think a lot of times they're probably using like very similar chipsets, so I would think they would support those frequencies. But I mean, maybe that's the limitation. I don't know. Maybe
yeah.
Maybe they feel like home users can't be trusted.
Well, that too. Also, there's a special certification, as Mike was mentioning. So that could also be, you know, you already have access to, what, 180, 100, almost 200 megahertz of spectrum. If you don't have to get the DFS certification, you can still say it's Wi-Fi. Are you going to spend the extra money? Home consumer is not going to know it. And also, it adds complexity to the system and say, hey, you know, if you use this one, if you're in, you know, your equipment gets a bad name because if somebody sets it up for a DFS, or by default, using auto mode, chooses the DFS channel, has to wait 60 seconds before devices can connect to it. And if it DFS hits, goes down for a minute in the middle of somebody's gaming session, that's a router issue. Yeah, and it's blatantly obvious because it's, you see the Wi-Fi connection go down. So if I were developing a router, I would be very hesitant to utilize that. And even if I were using a CPE, I would even if it was available in the MikroTik apps, I don't know if I would use it for my customers on 5 gig.
Something is like in the middle of an apartment. So you've got like a 5-story apartment complex. You're in the middle of it. It's unlikely you're going to see it, but that doesn't mean you're not going to get false positives, which would still cause you problems. So you might be better served just avoiding it, I guess, if you could.
Yeah. And that's the thing is the, you know, false positives, any kind of noise, as long as it matches what the radar and what the military says it's supposed to match, you're supposed to hit on that. And, you know, it's, some manufacturers seem to be better than others, and, you know, seem to be able to work around that some at particular times. I'm not. Yeah, it's, and there's definite, and there's definitely been times where there's firmwares that have gotten out for various manufacturers that let you utilize certain DFS frequencies illegally and or other portions of the spectrum illegally. So that's definitely a problem in the industry, and it's probably something else that the bad WISTs do somewhat frequently. But I don't see them doing that, so I can't categorize them as doing that. But
fair enough.
Yeah. So that's what you're looking at, and that's what you're working with, and that's why I don't think I would run it in a home router situation.
Right. Good talk. All right, Mikey, you said you had some April Fool's clearing to do. I figured we'd probably get that before we forget about it. Were you lying to people?
Yes.
You're the worst.
So let me see which ones... see all of my lies.
I saw Kevin Myers' MikroTik post about how they were doing a chassis-based switch or something.
Oh, Mike. Yeah, that one was brilliant. I showed that to my boss on April 1st. Oh, gosh. It was the CRS 404.
404.
Yeah.
It's right there in the name.
First-in-class spineless switching.
Spineless switching.
I love it, that.
Yeah, no, I didn't put nearly that much effort into mine. Mine was after seeing the first couple of April Fool's jokes from other people, I was like, oh, it's April Fool's Day. What can I come up with real quick?
Worst.
And all day you were posting that random crap.
I hate it, man. I hate April Fool's Day.
So I put Transview has come back on the scene with a wideband 5G NR carrier aggregation 3.5 and 5 gigahertz line dedicated for the WISP industry, designed for the WISP industry. I don't think Transio has come back in any capacity whatsoever, and they're definitely not doing anything 5G carrier aggregation. That said, if somebody made a 5G NR carrier aggregation 3.5 and 5 gigahertz radio, that would be amazing. Because it's one of those things where you know, if you could do it in, you know, CBRS where you've got, you know, some sort of, well, if you're able to get a PAL license, you know, you've got some license channels, then you can just spin up extra channels as needed for extra capacity. That'd be kick-ass. Fortunately, none of that's really a thing. I also said that Ubiquiti has countered their recent bad news by releasing SNMP stacks for all platforms without and improved existing stacks, paving the way for high-performance open monitoring.
I actually read that and thought it was legit. Oh, great. Great job, Mike.
I was a little hopeful there for a moment. Then I was like, it's April 1st. And it's Mike.
Ubiquiti doing something good for the operator or industry or open, probably not happening.
That would be brilliant, though, for them to do to counter all the bad press. Like,
is it do something that people actually want?
It put out and okay, I say how hard could it be, but it's probably very difficult to do it well, and continue supporting it into the future. But like, compared to the misery that they've gone through in these last few months.
Why don't we just go ahead and talk about the additional news that came out on the Ubiquiti breach, right? There were two missives. One person that was like an insider, right, said that they severely downplayed what happened in the breach and that they were trying to kind of use some vagaries to point fingers at other people when it was actually really just their fault.
Their third party cloud provider was just AWS. So it was their AWS account got compromised. There was no, you know, outsourced managed service company. No, it was just their own AWS account. And Ubiquiti sticking by the, you know, there's no evidence of any, you know, of accessing, customer information or, you know, the source code or anything like that. And per the whistleblower, there's no evidence because they don't have any systems in place to log anything.
Right. There's no
logging. There would never be evidence of anything because they don't log it.
So it wasn't an untrue statement. It just wasn't the whole truth, which sucks. And so Ubiquiti countered or something? I didn't actually read that part. I just read the original whistleblower guy. Didn't Ubiquiti basically confirm what that guy said?
They confirmed it by just saying, you know, we're sticking by what we said of, you know, there's no evidence that this happened, blah, 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 blah. It's like, so you didn't dispute anything that I said. You didn't dispute any of my claims. You just reaffirmed your claim.
Yeah, and they highly recommended that everyone change their passwords. We haven't seen large-scale UniFi attacks that have been publicly announced. Like somebody saying, my 2,000 devices that I was managing off of UniFi online I've lost the entire of this network. It was this really important thing. And, oh, by the way, you know, they got in and we have all this monitoring. So it's not, Ubiquiti, I feel like it's a little bit unfair that, yes, okay, they got hacked and it was very severe, but they also probably, the attackers probably didn't get the information. They might not have known what they were working with, and or, you know, they didn't actually get anything out. And because we haven't been seeing any of the fallout that a lot of the security guys were saying, oh, this is all you, everybody needs to change their passwords. Your, you know, accounts can all be accessed. That's not happening.
To me, the account access, which, you know, because everyone's all like, you know, oh, change your password and use two-factor and it's not a problem. I don't care about my account access. That's the least important, that's the least disastrous thing in my mind in this scenario. It's A, that Ubiquiti is covering something up and they're being mistruthful about what's going on. That's one of the biggest problems. And then doubling down on being on the lack of truth. And then two, the fact that like that they don't have a way of knowing how bad it really is. Like one of the things is, you know, they could have access to the source code. Not taking it being my concern, but in manipulating it. Did they manipulate the source code in some way?
Tool chain hack a la SolarWinds.
Yeah. And so it's like, so then how, like, and because of the lack of knowing what's going on, how do they determine what's clean?
And I mean, just because, just because the information isn't out in public and being compromised doesn't mean it wasn't sold to like a state actor, or a state actor grabbed it and is just cherry picking which person that they're attempting to exfiltrate information or whatever it happens to be.
Sure. Yeah. And it's not even like the at face value things that bother me. It's they don't know, they don't have a way of knowing, and they're not being truthful about it. Those are the two big problems to me.
Yeah. I'm not going to defend you.
Yeah. I'm going to say too, wordsmithing is nothing new. Right. There's always been spin doctors as long as there's been information being disseminated to other people. So this isn't new. Clever, clever releases because, none of it was necessarily untrue. It was just really interesting interpretations of the truth. So, credit where credit's due. It was a pretty good write-up.
Yeah, they did an excellent job.
I get them points for that, for their chutzpah. It's anytime you see a missive from a company, there's always a lot of stuff they're not saying. Like, just in my experience, in my personal experience from, working for some large companies before, I'm not saying Red Hat because I'm just a sales guy now. I don't see anything. But in companies before this, I've worked for many. I've seen some definite wordsmithing and some spin doctory. I don't know, whatever that is. I've seen some definite spin on stuff. Part of it is I've seen before where something sounds really bad, but it wasn't so bad. So rather than freak everybody out, you wordsmith it in such a way where it is true, but you're trying not to have everybody freak out. So I've seen that before. I'm not saying this is that or this isn't that, but it's just, it's rough. It's rough. I could see both sides of the coin. I'm a guy who's in the company and my livelihood depends on the stock not plummeting. I'm sure I could come up with creative ways to disseminate this information as well. I'm not about lying. I'm big on transparency, but yeah, I get it. And also too, you think about it, if you're the guy writing this missive, that it's not just your job on the line. It's like a lot of other people's livelihood. So, I can't not have empathy for people. I get the position. Well, I'm sure this individual found themselves in. So that sucks. It sucks for everybody, to be honest. But
secondarily, there's a lot of how many times have we simplified things for customers? And, you had a firewall rule that something got goofed up, and instead of it working the way it's supposed to have, this customer went down because of whatever the rule was, or this port goes. You just tell the customer, we had an issue with the router and we fixed it, we solved it, blah. They don't care. They don't need to know. Like, there is a level of simplification and wordsmithing that is, to be honest, is completely fine. I would argue that the wordsmithing here has gone beyond
reasonable simplification. Yeah.
Fairness to the customer. And fairness to the stockholders.
Well, what you were talking to before, the audience is, you know, an end user that doesn't understand stuff. Whereas Ubiquiti's audience that they're talking to are highly technical people who absolutely understand the repercussions of everything. So it's
many of them perhaps handle it better than Ubiquiti.
I would say I would say the vast majority of them. Let's say that.
Yeah. The people who will actually be getting the notification. Yes.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Although there are a lot of just regular old home users that use Ubiquiti stuff I know of. So
yeah.
All right. I didn't even think about that.
Oh yeah, but then you know, when countered from something technical saying, well, your response could mean this, 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 and this, and then you just dismiss it I get, you know, that's probably the corporate liability thing, but it's like, it just screams, yeah, that's what it is. Like, you know, you didn't re-explain it, you didn't do this, you didn't do that, you're just like, you just brushed it aside. It's like, okay, well, yeah, I see corporate brush something aside. That means it's probably correct.
I don't know. Sometimes that's what they tell people to do. Like, if they're embroiled in a scandal, is just say nothing, give them no evidence. But I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to be fair, Ubiquiti is publicly traded. Like, you know, they have only X amount of words that they can say before there's issues.
Fair enough.
And, yeah, so... Speaking of publicly traded, we have a new Stonks channel.
Oh. I did have two more things.
Thanks to Andrew Thrift for naming it Stonks.
Yeah.
I'm going to make sure I get these two more in. Apologies before we forget about it.
Okay.
So to not leave Ubiquiti in the cold for being the only wireless vendor that I trashed, I also said, Cambium Networks releases CN Maestro 4.0 with a usable configuration management UI.
Dude, that's some serious shade right there.
Yeah, and their only comeback is that, well, at least it works.
So then... The last one of the day that was a joke. I had a couple more serious ones after that. I'm not sure how to pronounce the company name. Senayo. I know they're an old-time vendor. Has finally followed up the CB3 with the CB4 in 802.11ax-based solution. The CB4 Plus will have simultaneous dual-band 2.4 and 5 through 6 gigahertz.
Sweet action.
Yeah.
I hate April Fool's Day.
Yeah. That said, we do have a good bit of a list of publicly traded companies inside of the wireless internet service provider space. Which, Mike, your goal is to have one of each.
Yes, my intention is to get one of each, you know, one share of each publicly traded vendor in our space. Do not take that as sound investing advice. That's just something.
Are you doing
weird
it
to
so
do?
That you can yell at them and say that you own them, that you're their boss, and they need to get off their asses and do this or that?
I have thought about in the past how much would I have to be able to do that and actually
one share
taken seriously.
One share.
Well, and to be taken seriously.
Oh, it's gonna take a lot more than that.
Probably. Yeah.
well, sure, and it's not something I could ever afford. But it's just like, you know, because it's like,
I don't know how much of Cambium did you buy last year when they were at the $3.20.
I do have more than one share of Cambium, and that has done amazing to my portfolio. I have doubled or tripled my total.
You better be in the closing in. Well, actually, when did you buy in, I guess?
Well, I bought in multiple stages. Yeah. And so, like, in the past, or no, the hold on, let me see here. In the past 1 year, I think I have had a 400% increase. So yeah, it's definitely more than double or triple. I mean, in the last year, 400% increase. Yeah. From my tech related stock, a lot of it Cambium, but I've got some others in there too. But it's that's the thing is, like, most of the tech related stocks are going up. I mean, Ubiquity obviously had a problem a couple weeks ago with their stock.
Time to buy them, though. If you're wanting to buy, now's the time to buy Ubiquity. Not stock advice, just a random dude making.
But I also have like one of those target date like mutual fund things where it's like, you know, they adjust the its portfolio over time from very aggressive to, you know, more reliable as it gets closer to your retirement. And of course, I'm not retiring for a long time. So I chose one that's way out, and it's pretty aggressive compared to a lot of other things. It's not even registering on the radar of my most aggressive stuff. Cause all my, and obviously that's bad for diversity, but it's like all of my WISP related stocks have just done really well. But you know, it's like, you know, and then, you know, once I get one of everything in WISP related, then I'll go to other, you know, like, you know, Juniper and Cisco and stuff. It's just get one, you know, I'll go get one share of this. And, you know, I think
there's only like, what, 60,000 publicly traded stocks or something like that.
just get one of each. I think I heard that Nokia was only like $3 a share. So, like,
oh yeah. They're
maybe
super
I'll buy
cheap.
A couple of those.
Yeah, well, so if you're into this, if you have a couple $1,000, the trick is buy Nokia when they're a couple cents lower, sell it when a couple of cents higher. You make a couple bucks every other day on just doing that, rinsing and repeating. Just because you're working on the volume of shares, but just know Nokia has done not a lot but go down, other than the Wall Street Bets slight bump.
My thought with Nokia is that you know, as we're getting into all of these, you know, 5G build outs, you know, they're one of only a couple cell infrastructure manufacturers. And you know, with the US, you know, with Biden's, you know, $100 billion broadband plan, you know, some of that's going to be going to companies like this. It's going to go up. Maybe not a lot, but, you know, when someone dumps $100 billion into your industry, your stock's probably going to go up.
Yeah.
Probably.
No. As I like to say, there was three industries that did well in the last year. And that would be healthcare, alcohol / marijuana, tobacco, any of those food services and the, you know, those things, and internet. If you were in one of those three industries, you did great last year because you all made money. And most of those companies that are in that industry have done nothing but gone up. I mean, heck, Iron Mountain went up. Finally.
But they're named after a mountain.
Yeah, they're getting into data centers, just FYI. But yeah, there's a few different companies if you're wanting to follow kind of that. And it is actually interesting listening to publicly traded the like reports, because you kind of get an idea of where Ubiquity, Cambium, Aviat, those are the ones that I particularly follow. But there's other companies where they're kind of leadership goals are, and that gives you a different perspective than, like, especially for the Ubiquity side. Yeah. Yeah. If you're on like the Ubiquity forums and stuff, you get, you know, the user grunts, the support grunts and general that level of stuff. So, yeah, it's kind of fun. Definitely I recommend always investing in stocks that you know more about than anyone else, because that's going to make you better money, in my opinion, because it's as close to insider trading as you can possibly get without breaking the law.
Rock and roll, man.
But
all right, you guys, we're over $1.45 on this one. So I reckon we stick a fork in it. What do you think? All right, cool. All right, Mikey from Chicagoland, if people out in the real world want to get a hold of you on the virtual world, how would you have them do that?
Patreon.com/ The Brothers Wisp.
All right, rock and roll. What he's trying to say is get into the Little Brothers with Slack, right? You go to patreon.com/ The Brothers Wisp, throw us a couple bones, get access to Patreon only Slack, and slide into his DMs. All right, Mikey. Or not Mikey. I'm looking at Tommy. Tommy Krogan, if you want people out on the internet, how do you how would you have them connect you?
Tommy@lostcreek.tech. You can shoot me an email. I am totally fine if you just email me to warn me about doing horrible ideas. a month ago when I was on here with saying that I was going to be running 2004s in production, I got more than one email telling me how horrible of an idea it was. And I totally recognize the foolishness of my mistakes. As of yet, I've not been bitten in the butt by that. I've got a 2004 that's gotten full tables from HE. I was running, I think, 6 gigs of bandwidth through it for like 3 or 4 days just to try and get it to break. And then I gave up. And then I have another one that's been getting 2 full tables with running a copper, everything that everyone says, this is what causes problems.
Everything you're not supposed to do.
Yeah, you're not supposed to do. I haven't run OSPF on it, but dagnabbit, I've tried everything to get my damn things to crash, and it won't. So I am a lucky son of a gun. So yeah, feel free to reach out to me to tell me I'm an idiot. It's always entertaining for me. Hope you all have a wonderful rest of your time, or reach out to me for consulting questions. Yeah. Or if you're on the Brothers Wisp, I'm more than happy to contribute my paltry information or my Googling abilities. Yeah. To help you solve your problem.
I guess in recent times I've passed some consulting over to Tommy, and I had somebody reach back out and say, I really like Tommy. And I was like, yeah, me too, dude. It's like, it makes sense. Don't look so confused.
I don't know who would say that.
I really like this guy.
I'm pretty certain I'm in like 3 lawsuits. Yeah. Right now.
Minimum. All right. Do you work for Ubiquity? Minimum, yeah. I'm just curious. No. If you want to get a hold of me, I am greg@gregsoul.com, or you go to gregsoul.com, check out my blog, where I'm mostly blogging about Ansible these days, but anything else as well. Let's see what else. Yeah, if you want to get quick contact with me, email's a good way, or just in Little Brothers with Slack. I really love perusing in there. If I see the little red mark pop up as I got like a direct message, I'm usually pretty good about answering those, or if you at me in there as well. I guess any questions, comments, any of that stuff, keep them coming at us, and we'll talk to you guys next time. Bye.
Yeah.
Right, time to hit stop. We're loud and annoying, but we're informative. Stop. Facts, we're not disappointing. Just give us a listen, because fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed